Over the next three decades, many scientists worked to develop and refine these ideas as they pondered the questions both Oparin and Darwin had raised. How could life have evolved from simple chemicals?
Since the 1950s, many scientists have felt that they could simulate chemical evolution, the kind that might have happened on the early Earth. And what they're trying to do is to take simple chemicals and put them together to form amino acids.
These amino acids are actually chemical compounds. 20 different types of amino acids are common in living organisms. They comprise about half the dry weight of every cell. Amino acids are the building blocks of larger molecules called proteins. And proteins are the primary components of every cell that has ever existed on the Earth.
Proteins have a wide range of function in the cell, everything from structural requirements in terms of scaffolding of the cell, the cytoskeleton, to enzymes.
Proteins do all the day-to-day jobs inside of the cell, making energy, moving things around, cleaning up the cell. And the earliest cells had to have those same proteins because they needed those same jobs done. So the proteins in the earliest cell and the proteins today were of the same type of complexity.
Scientists realize that the complex structure of protein molecules are keys to understanding how life on Earth began.
By the 1960s, scientists had determined that even simple cells are made of thousands of different types of proteins. And the function of these molecules derives from their highly complex three-dimensional shapes. The irregular shapes of some proteins allow them to catalyze or trigger chemical reactions because of the hand and glove fit that they have with other molecules in the cell. While other protein molecules form interlocking structural components.
The individual parts of a bacterial motor, like this ring structure, are each made of either a single protein molecule or an assembly of proteins fitted together into a specific shape. These proteins consist of one or more chains containing hundreds or thousands of individual amino acids. Biologists have compared the 20 different amino acids used to build protein chains to the 26 letters of the English alphabet.
Alphabetic letters can be arranged in a huge number of possible combinations, and it's the sequential arrangement of the letters that determines whether you have meaningful words and sentences. If the letters are arranged correctly, you'll get meaningful text. But if they're not arranged correctly, you'll get gibberish. And the same principle applies for amino acids and proteins.
There are at least 30,000 distinct types of proteins, each made of a different combination of the same 20 amino acids. They are arranged, like letters, to form chains, often hundreds of units long. If the amino acids are sequenced correctly, then the chain will fold into a functioning protein.
Proteins are arranged in such a way that their amino acids collapse on one another and form an architecture that's pre-programmed by the hundreds of amino acids along the protein chain. So the order of those amino acids inside of a protein is essential to getting the right shape.
This arrangement is critical, for if the amino acids are incorrectly sequenced, a useless chain forms, and instead of folding into a protein, it will be destroyed in the cell. As science reveals the intricate construction of proteins, Origin of Life researchers are confronted with a difficult question. Could amino acids floating in a primordial ocean have arranged themselves into protein molecules through purely random interactions?
Obviously, it is very difficult to imagine how in the primordial oceans the amino acids could organize themselves one after another into the right sequence to form even the simplest protein. And a good way to think about this is to think about the English language and how difficult it would be to string together a meaningful English sentence by randomly placing the letters one after another.
As an illustration, consider the difficulty of forming just one line of Shakespeare's play, Hamlet, by dropping Scrabble letters randomly onto a tabletop. only one of 26 possible letters will work correctly at each of the 30 sites in the phrase. The probability of successfully assembling Shakespeare's classic line by pure chance is determined by computing 1 over 26 to the 30th power. The result is a staggering 1 chance in 2,810 trillion octillion. Yet while these odds are beyond comprehension, they seem almost reasonable when compared to the probability of randomly forming just one of the simplest protein molecules known to science. The smallest proteins in nature are comprised of about 100 amino acids. These chemical components must align in specific positions along a chain. Biologists have estimated that on a planet covered by a primordial soup, filled with complete sets of all 20 types of amino acids, the time necessary to construct a functional protein of 100 units would be roughly equivalent to the oldest estimated age of the universe multiplied by 10 to the 60th power. But despite this inconceivable time frame, even if our protein somehow correctly self-assembled, the mystery of life's origin is still far from resolved.
Let's just say that against all odds, against everything we know about science, you do get 100 amino acid long protein by chance. What do you have? Well, you have one protein. That's it. We don't have life because even the simplest cell requires over 600 proteins in order for it to be functional, in order for it to be alive. So mainstream scientists no longer think that life and the building blocks of life could originate by chance. They're now looking for a way to explain the building blocks and explain life's organization by some form of law or combination of laws that would allow that to happen. Chance is no longer an option.
By the early 1960s, most scientists had ruled out the possibility that random chemical reactions in the primordial waters of the early Earth had once produced complex protein molecules and the first living cells. Yet despite the limitations of blind chance, Origin of Life researchers continued their efforts to find a natural process that could have generated the first life.
The problem of biological origins has, for a very long time, I would say, has been a real deep interest to me just because of the scale of the problem, the importance of it. Where did we come from? Why are we here? All that kind of question. Probed from the point of view of natural science.
During the late 1960s and throughout the 70s and early 80s, Dean Kenyon was one of the leading chemical evolutionary theorists in the world. And like others in this field, he was trying to explain how life on Earth began through a purely natural process.
In 1969, Kenyon co-authored the book Biochemical Predestination. In it, he presented an intriguing naturalistic explanation for the origin of complex protein molecules, the primary components of living cells. Kenyon wrote, life might have been biochemically predestined by the properties of attraction that exist between its chemical parts, particularly between amino acids in proteins.
At the time that biochemical predestination came out, I and my co-author were totally convinced that we had the scientific explanation for origins.
Kenyon proposed that the chemical properties of the amino acids caused them to be attracted to each other, forming the long chains that became the first proteins, the most important components in the living cell. And this meant that life was effectively inevitable, predestined by nothing more than chemistry.
Many scientists embraced Kenyon's ideas, and over the next 20 years, biochemical predestination became a best-selling text on the theory of chemical evolution. Yet 5 years after the book's publication, Kenyon quietly began to doubt the plausibility of his own theory.
It was during that whole period of time that my doubts about certain aspects of the evolutionary account became apparent. When coming into contact with a powerful counter-argument given to me by one of my students, and I could not refute that counter-argument.
Kenyon was challenged to explain how the first proteins could have been assembled without the help of genetic instructions. In living cells today, chains of amino acids are not formed directly by forces of attraction between their parts, the scenario Kenyon envisioned on the early Earth. Instead, another large molecule within the cell stores instructions for sequencing the amino acids in proteins. It is called DNA.
Initially, Kenyon believed that proteins could have formed directly from amino acids without any DNA assembly instructions. And that's why so many scientists were excited about his theory. But the more he and others learned about the properties of amino acids and proteins, the more he began to doubt that proteins could self-assemble without DNA.
In DNA, Kenyon encountered a molecule with a property he could not explain through natural processes. For locked securely within its double helix structure is a wealth of information in the form of precisely sequenced chemicals that scientists represent with the letters A, C, T, and G, for adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. In a written language, information is communicated by a precise arrangement of letters. In the same way, the instructions necessary to assemble amino acids into proteins are conveyed by the sequences of chemicals arranged along the spine of the DNA. This chemical code has been called the language of life, and it is the most densely packed and elaborately detailed assembly of information in the known universe.
Like other scientists working on the origin of life, Kenyon realized he had two choices. Either he had to explain where these genetic assembly instructions came from, or he had to explain how proteins could have arisen directly from amino acids without DNA in the primordial oceans. And in the end, he realized he could do neither.
It's an enormous problem how you could get together in one tiny submicroscopic volume of the primitive ocean all of the hundreds of different molecular components you would need in order for a self-replicating cycle to be established. And so my doubts about whether amino acids could order themselves into meaningful biological sequences on their own without pre-existing genetic material being present just reached, I guess for me, the intellectual breaking point sometime near the end of the decade of the 70s.
As Kenyon reevaluated his theory, new biochemical discoveries further weakened his conviction that amino acids could have organized themselves into proteins.
The more I conducted my own studies, including a period of time at NASA Ames Research Center, the more it became apparent that there were multiple difficulties with the chemical evolution account. And further experimental work showed that amino acids do not have the ability to order themselves into any biologically meaningful sequences.
Faced with mounting difficulties in his own theory and a growing body of scientific data about the importance of DNA, Kenyon was forced to confront the absolute necessity of genetic information.
The more I thought about the enormous problem that all of us who worked on this field had neglected to address, the problem of the origin of genetic information itself, then I really had to reassess my whole position regarding origins.
For Dean Kenyon, a new question became the focus of his search for life's origin. What was the source of the biological information in DNA?
If one could get at the origin of the messages, the encoded messages within the living machinery, then you would really be on to something far more intellectually satisfying than this chemical evolution theory.
Yet Kenyon faced a narrowing set of options, for he realized that as with pure chance, natural selection was also limited in its creative power. By definition, natural selection could not have functioned before the existence of the first living cell, for it can only act upon organisms capable of replicating themselves, cells equipped with DNA that pass on their genetic changes to future generations.
Without DNA, there is no self-replication. But without self-replication, there is no natural selection. So you can't use natural selection to explain the origin of DNA without assuming the existence of the very thing you're trying to explain.
Natural selection, chance, and his own theory of self-organization had all failed to explain the origin of genetic information. Now Kenyon saw only one alternative.
We have not the slightest chance of a chemical evolutionary origin for even the simplest of cells. So the concept of the intelligent design of life was immensely attractive to me and made a great deal of sense, as it very closely matched the multiple discoveries in molecular biology.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains, often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that's, that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
When I look at molecular machines or the incredibly complex process by which cells divide, I want to ask, is it possible that these things had an intelligence behind them, that there was a plan or a purpose to this structure? Science ought to be a search for the truth about the world. Now, we shouldn't prejudge what might be true. We shouldn't say, I don't like that explanation, so I'm going to put it to one side. Rather, when we come to a puzzle in nature, we ought to bring to that puzzle every possible cause that might explain it. One of the problems I have with evolutionary theory is it artificially rules out a kind of cause even before the evidence has a chance to speak. And the cause that's ruled out is intelligence.
Since the late 19th century, since the time of Darwin, in fact, in part because of Darwin's writing in The Origin of Species, scientists came to accept a convention, a definition of science that excluded the possibility of design as a scientific explanation. And it just means that if you're going to be scientific, you must limit yourself to explanations that invoke only natural causes. You can't invoke intelligence as a cause. And yet, curiously, we make inferences to intelligence all the time. It's part of our ordinary reasoning to recognize the effects of intelligence.
Consider, for example, these hieroglyphic messages carved upon the ruins of Egyptian monuments. No one would attribute the shapes and arrangements of these symbols to natural causes, like sandstorms or erosion. Instead, we recognize them as the work of ancient scribes, intelligent human agents. Similar reasoning leads us to conclude that the mysterious stone figures on the shores of Easter Island were not formed by the actions of wind and water over great periods of time. Nor do we presume that plants could grow into these familiar shapes without some manner of intelligent guidance.
Of course, we make these inferences all the time, and we know they're correct. But the question is, on what basis do we make these inferences? What are the features that enable us to recognize intelligence?
Recently, in a book titled The Design Inference, mathematician William Dembski has made an important breakthrough in understanding design reasoning. Dembski has identified the specific features of artifacts that cause us to recognize prior intelligent activity.
I came to this by trying to look at how do we reason about design? What are the logical moves that we have to go through in order to come to a conclusion of design? So what I'm trying to do is to establish reliable, empirical, scientifically rigorous criteria for deciding whether something is in fact designed. So I was looking at the logic of it. And what I found was you need improbability and you need specification, the right sort of pattern, these objective patterns.
According to Dembski, human beings correctly detect the activity of intelligence whenever they observe a highly improbable object or event that also matches a recognizable pattern. Just such a pattern is found in the Black Hills of South Dakota.
If you travel through the West, you'll see lots of different shapes on mountainsides, most of which mean nothing at all. They're just rocks strewn in various patterns. But what you don't see are the faces of Lincoln, Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and George Washington on mountainsides. The only place you see that is in South Dakota. And the reason it's there is because a sculptor, an eccentric sculptor, decided that he wanted to honor these presidents by spending the larger part of his life chiseling their faces in the side of that mountain. That pattern is improbable. A random hillside is also improbable, but a random hillside doesn't specify anything. We do know, though, that there were four guys who were presidents of the United States who had particular patterns with their faces, and those patterns on the mountainside in South Dakota match faces elsewhere.
If I look up and see the faces, I immediately recognize that they match the faces of the four presidents that are known from money or portraits at the National Gallery or paintings and books. And so I realize when I look at Mount Rushmore, we have not only a highly improbable configuration of rock, but one which matches an independently given pattern that reliably indicates intelligence.
So we have a small probability, specification, it's design.
On a seashore, another improbable pattern etched into the earth illustrates how we detect design. No one would infer that this message was written by the movement of the tides. Instead, because of the characteristics of this pattern, we identify the words as the products of intelligence.
That improbable arrangement also conforms to an independently given pattern, namely the shapes of the letters that we recognize from English alphabet and the words that we know from English vocabulary. And so it's the improbability of the arrangement plus the fact that it conforms to an independently given pattern that triggers the awareness of design.
This illustration suggests that William Dembski's criteria for design detection, small probability and specification, are essentially equivalent to information. The type of information present not only in pictures, numeric sequences, and written texts, but also encoded into living cells.
DNA has a structure that is ideal for carrying information in the A's, T's, C's, and G's. The basis of the double helix of DNA is the potential for storing a tremendous amount of information.
There is, in fact, no entity in the known universe that stores and transmits more information more efficiently than the DNA molecule. A full complement of human DNA has 3 billion individual characters. Analysis of the DNA molecule's coding regions show that its chemical characters have a specific arrangement that allows them to convey detailed instructions or information, much like letters in a meaningful sentence or binary digits in a computer code.
Bill Gates has said that DNA is like a computer program, only much more complex than any we've been able to devise. And if you reflect on that even for a minute, it's a highly suggestive observation, because we know that Bill Gates does not employ wind and erosion or random number generators to generate his software. Instead, he employs intelligent engineers, software engineers. And so everything we know in our experience suggests that information-rich systems arise from intelligent design. But what do we make of the fact that there is information in life, in every living cell of every living organism? That's the fundamental mystery. Where does that information come from?
For the past 15 years, philosopher and scientist Stephen Meyer has worked to answer this question. Meyer has developed an argument to demonstrate that intelligent design provides the best explanation for the origin of information necessary to build the first living cell.
The information that
the DNA molecule holds.
It's part of our knowledge base that intelligent agents can produce information-rich systems. So the argument is not based on what we don't know, but it's based on what we do know about the cause and effect structure of the world. We know at present there is no naturalistic explanation, no natural cause that produces information. Not natural selection, not self-organizational processes, not pure chance. But we do know of a cause which is capable of producing information, and that is intelligence. So when we find an information-rich system in the cell, in the DNA molecule specifically, we can infer that an intelligence played a role in the origin of that system, even if we weren't there to observe the system coming into existence.
Meyer's work on the origin of genetic information is now one part of a comprehensive scientific case for design, developed by a network of philosophers and scientists from throughout the world. Their objective is to reassess an idea that has dominated biology for more than a century. In the process, they have given birth to a theory that has become known as intelligent design.
To me, the great promise of design is it gives us a new tool and explanation that belongs in the toolkit of science. Intelligent causes are real, they leave evidence of their existence, and a healthy science is a science that seeks the truth and lets the evidence speak for itself.
The argument for intelligent design is based on observation of the facts. Now that's my definition of good science. It's observation of the facts. Now when you observe the facts, as Michael Behe has done, what do you observe? You observe this incredible pattern of interrelated complexity.
And the way we conclude intelligent design for the bacterial flagellum is the same way we conclude intelligent design for an outboard motor. When we see an outboard motor, we see the way the parts interact and so on. We know somebody made that. The reasoning is the same for biological machines. So the idea of intelligent design is a completely scientific one. Certainly it might have religious implications, but it does not depend on religious premises.
When I look at the evidence objectively, without ruling out the possibility of design, design just leaps up as the most likely explanation. And that's why I believe that it's true.
I think design is back on the table. You know, we can't explain these systems by natural law. And if we're searching for truth, and they are in fact designed, if we have to be design engineers to understand them, then I say, what's the problem? You know, you go where the data leads you. And the implications, yeah, they have profound metaphysical implications, but so be it.
So it's a powerful idea that the universe is rational and comprehensible, underwritten by a supreme intelligence that meant for this world to be understood, is something that underwrites then the program of science, because then you can go out and look at the world and the world will make sense. If it's all just a chaotic assemblage, there's no reason to expect any rationality out there. But if it in fact is the product of a mind, then you can go out and science becomes this enormous, wonderful puzzle-solving project in which you can expect to find rationality and beauty and comprehensibility right at the foundation of things.
150 years ago, Charles Darwin transformed science with his theory of natural selection. Today, that theory faces a formidable challenge. Intelligent design has sparked intense debate over the origin of life on Earth. And for a growing number of scientists, it represents a paradigm. An idea with the power to, once again, redefine the foundations of scientific thought.
During the 19th century, scientists believed that there were two fundamental entities, matter and energy. But as we enter the 21st century, there's a third fundamental entity that science has had to recognize, and that is information. And so as we encounter the biology of the information age, the suspicion is growing that what we're seeing in the DNA molecule is actually an artifact of mind, an artifact of intelligence, something that can only be explained by intelligent design.